Welcome to the Deadcast.
July 26th, 1974. 65-year-old Alice Curtis, a retired school teacher living in Jacksonville, Florida, is inside of her home. She hears some sound at the window, turns around to find a man coming inside. Curtis is bound and gagged while the man ransacks her home before fleeing into the night. She lies there, struggling to escape, only to choke on her own dentures and die. Not long after this, a car cruises down the street. It is Curtis's car. The driver is looking for a place to abandon it. He sees two young girls, Lillian and Mylett Anderson. The driver, John Paul Knowles, instantly recognizes them and realizes that they too could recognize him. He can't allow this to happen, for Knowles has just escaped from jail. Knowles, fearing that they might report him, forces the two girls, aged 11 and 7, into his car and drives off. Lillian and Mylett will not survive the night, however, as Knowles will strangle both of the girls before dumping their bodies in a swamp. Few realize it at the time, but these murders mark the beginning of a spree that John Paul Knowles is to go on over the next 4 months, murders that will earn him the nickname of the Casanova Killer. Hello again, and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling independent author Ian Totten, and I'd like to thank you for joining me once again, as this week we look at what can arguably be called my personal favorite serial killer, and it has nothing to do with the man's crimes. It's just his I-don't-give-a-fuck attitude. We'll get into that, though. Before we dive into the case, however, a couple of plugs as normal. If you'd like to follow me on social media, you can find me on Instagram at Ian Totten Author, Facebook at Ian Totten Author, Twitter at Author Totten. If you'd like to help support the show, you can do that in a number of ways. I am on Patreon at Ian Totten Author, where you can sign up, and I think one of the tiers, if you're signed up for 3 months, you'll get a free book out of the deal. I'm also on PayPal and Venmo at Ian Totten if you'd like to make a one-time donation to the show and help with the production of it. You can also go on your favorite podcast app and leave a 5-star review. That really does help the show. It drives us up the charts and allows us to reach new audiences. Before I forget, I'm going to throw out our book of the week early this week. And that is Dreamweaver by international best-selling horror author Alistair Cross. I've been reading the book off and on over the last 2 weeks, and I can't heap enough praise on Alistair. He's got a very unique, enjoyable style. He's not like any horror I have read before, so if you're in the market for a new book, check out Dream Reaper. He's got a number of other books out, as well as the Thorn and Cross series with international best-selling author Tamara Thorne. So check him out. You can find him on Amazon. I know they're on Kindle, and I know that he has just released a bunch of his books on audiobook on Audible. All right, get yourself something to drink, sit back and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. Alright, so today we're going to be looking at the Casanova Killer, John Paul Knowles. And as I said there in the preamble, if you gotta have one favorite serial killer, he would be my pick. And it's just because the man did not care at all. I mean, he's the epitome of no fucks left to give. He really is, and you'll learn more about that as we get into his story. Yeah, he was an awful human being. I don't admire anything about him, with that one exception. He just did not give a shit. And to look at him, he had sort of a roguish look. If you are familiar with professional wrestling, as I know a number of the fans of this show are, he looked a little bit like an older David Von Erich, had David Von Erich lived past his early 20s. And he kind of had a Bon Scott vibe going to him as far as his mode of dress. Bon Scott being the original lead singer for AC/DC. You know, he had that the big hair that was long but not too long. And it was because of this that Knowles ended up getting the moniker of the Casanova Killer. It wasn't because he was, you know, sweet-talking women left and right, although he did do that. So, who was John Paul Knowles? Well, he was born April 17th, 1946, in Orlando, Florida. And by all accounts, he turned to petty crime at a fairly young age, mostly stealing things. And this led his father to give him up to the foster care system, and Knowles ended up bouncing in and out of foster homes and reformatories over the next few years. Now, when Knowles was 19, he had his first really serious run-in with the law. I mean, prior to this, he'd had run-in with the law, which is what ended him up in reformatories, but this one was his first serious one. He kidnapped a police officer and somehow managed to get himself let go. However, this started a pattern in Knowles' life where he would spend some time out of prison and then do 6 months. Spend some time out, do 6 months. And he followed this pattern for the next 8 years. In 1974, he was serving another prison term when he began to correspond with a divorced woman in California named Angela Kovic. Now, it's easy to see why Kovic fell for Knowles. He was fairly suave, and he had a bit of that bad boy aura going for him. He was in what is now Florida State Prison, and Kovic fell head over heels for Knowles. At one point, she even traveled to Florida to visit Knowles at the prison, at which point he proposed to her. And Kovic ended up hiring a lawyer to work on Knowles' behalf, and Knowles was able to get parole because of this. Kovic then paid for Knowles to fly cross-country to California, to San Francisco, to be with her so that they could get married. However, unbeknownst to Knowles, Kovic had gone to see a psychic who told her something along the lines of she needed to be careful of the dangerous new man who was coming into her life. When Knowles arrived in California to be with Kovic, she later said that she instantly realized that he projected a quote-unquote aura of fear, and she ended up calling off the wedding and breaking up with Knowles. Now, according to Knowles' own statements, that night in San Francisco, as he walked the streets on his own, he killed 3 people. But again, this has never been verified outside of what Knowles said. And more likely than not, it could be that he was looking to further bolster his reputation by telling the cops this. He returned to Jacksonville, Florida the next day, and apparently the rejection caused by his breakup with Kovac led Knowles to become an even more violent individual. In fact, he ended up back in jail. This was like a county jail in Jacksonville after he pulled a knife on a bartender during a fight. And it was this one incident that would lead to John Paul Knowles going on his murderous rampage across a number of different states. July 26th, 1974, as I said in the trailer, was the day that John Paul Knowles picked the lock to his cell and escaped, which is when he went to the house of 65-year-old Alice Curtis, bound and gagged her, and left her to die. One thing I didn't bring up in the trailer is the fact that Knowles actually drove around Jacksonville in Curtis's car for a few days until police figured out that it had been stolen from the house, at which point they were quickly able to connect Knowles with the murder and stolen vehicle. He decided at that point that he was going to get rid of the car, which is when he went to drop it off on a residential street and saw the two girls, 11-year-old Lillian Anderson and her 7-year-old sister, Mylette. Now, the girl's mother was a friend of Knowles' mother. He became convinced that the girls had seen him and recognized him, and that they would turn around and tell the police that they had seen him, so Knowles forced them into the car, drove off, at which point he strangled them both to death and buried their bodies in a swamp outside of Jacksonville. Now, on August 1st, Knowles claimed a teenage girl who was walking home, although at the time police did not have her identity. And it wasn't until December 21st of 2011 that she was identified as Ima Jean Sanders, who had run away from her home in Beaumont, Texas, to live with her mother in Warner Robins, Georgia. The next day, on August 2nd, he met Marjorie Howe, who was 49 years old, in Atlantic Beach, Florida. It's unknown whether he forced his way into the home or whether Marjorie invited Knowles inside. However, it doesn't matter because the result was the same, as Knowles ended up strangling Marjorie to death with a nylon stocking and stealing her television set, which I assume he fenced for money. One thing that should be noted, however, about Knowles is with each passing murder, he escalated what he did to the victims, eventually going into rape on some of the victims, although not all of them, as well as what could best be described as abuse of the corpse. On August 23rd, Knowles, who had been drifting aimlessly through Florida, ended up in Mucela, Georgia, where he invaded the home of Kathy Pierce. He ended up strangling Pierce to death with a telephone cord while her 3-year-old son looked on. Knowles did not harm the child in any way. He killed the mother and then fled. And I know I'm jumping around quite a bit here. Knowles' path through the states is kind of hard to follow, as although Knowles did use some of his victims' credit cards, he was sparing in it, mostly trading on cash or stealing what he needed as he worked his way up into Ohio, where on September 3rd in Lima, he met a businessman named William Bates at a tavern, and the two of them shared a few drinks. Now, there was actually a witness in the beginnings of this crime, as the bartender who knew Bates later told police that he recalled Bates and a young redheaded man having several drinks before leaving together. Bates's wife eventually reported him missing, and it was at that time that the police found that his car was missing as well. They searched the lot at the bar where Bates had been, and surprisingly enough, found Alice Curtis's vehicle in the lot. Again, though, this was the 1970s. They did not have, you know, the tracking that they did now. There wasn't a lot of interplay between different police forces. So the police in Ohio had no idea what Curtis's car was doing up there at that point. In October, Bates's body was found in the woods. He had been strangled, and I've seen a couple different reports that state that he was possibly found nude, but again, there's a couple different reports. Some of them admit that fact. One I saw actually said that Bates's body was actually found fully clothed. So Knowles went on a bit of a driving run, and again, it's hard to know exactly what he did while he was on the road, although I suspect he probably burgled houses and stole anything else he could get his hands on. It's also possible he committed more murders that he just never confessed to. He did end up going to Sacramento before coming back east. He stopped at a campground in Ely, Nevada, and on September 18th of 1974, Noel shot two elderly campers, husband and wife, Emmett and Louise Johnson. And the police had no idea who had committed the murders because, naturally, Knowles didn't stick around. He stole money and credit cards and other valuables for them and split the area. And the police had no idea Knowles was linked to it until, again, he confessed to the murder. Just real quick, if you hear noises in the background of this recording, I'm not doing anything unsavory. I have a beagle named Charlie that likes to run around and scratch himself and just be a pretty happy puppy, and as anybody who has a dog knows, there's very little you can do to stop them when they feel like making some noise. 3 days after the murders in Utah, Knowles was in Sequin, Texas, and he spotted a female motorist who was stranded at the roadside with a broken-down car. When he decided to stop and quote-unquote help her, he ended up raping the woman before strangling her, after which he dragged her body through barbed wire and left her lying there. And this is the escalation that I talked about earlier. Initially, he would just strangle the victims and then leave them, but now here we see he's actually raped a woman before killing her, and then further done indignities to the body by dragging her through barbed wire. On September 23rd, he met beautician Ann Dawson in Birmingham, Alabama. Now, Dawson was pretty smitten with him, and they began to travel at Dawson's expense. Knowles eventually got tired of Dawson, and he killed her on the 29th. Now, Dawson's body has never been found. So, again, it's like I was talking about. We have no real idea his actual number of killings. Dawson was never found. And it's one of those things where it's like, okay, this guy was in multiple states over a few months span. How many people did he actually kill that he just never admitted to? from what we know over the next few weeks, he was in Oklahoma, Missouri, Iowa, and Minnesota. And by his own accounts, he didn't kill anyone in any of these states. Be interesting to see, however, the missing persons reports from the time frame in the end of September, early October 1974. I just have a feeling that they would be able to link a couple of them, even if it's tentatively, to John Paul Knowles. It is known that on October 16th, he was in Marlboro, Connecticut, and he broke into the home of Karen Wine and her 16-year-old daughter, Dawn. Knowles bound and raped both of them before strangling them to death with nylon stockings. And it was noted by police that the only thing missing from the house was a tape recorder. Knowles next appeared in Woodford, Virginia on October 18th, where he broke into the home of 53-year-old Doris Hosey, and he shot her to death with her husband's rifle. And this is a change in Knowles' MO. As we've seen, he mostly strangled his victims. So it might be a situation where he just was looking to kill somebody, or maybe she spotted him and he realized he had to get rid of her quick, because, you know, at this point there were APBs and things of that nature out in the South concerning John Paul Knowles. She was shot with her husband's rifle. He wiped the gun down, removing all of his fingerprints, and left the gun lying next to her. And this is one of those ones that Knowles admitted to after capture. The police had no idea that he had done it prior to that, as there was no sign of forced entry into the home. Nothing had been taken that they could tell, and there was also no sign of sexual assault. Something interesting of note here is that Knowles was still driving the car that he had stolen in Ohio. And he ended up back in Florida, down in Key West, where he picked up two hitchhikers with the intention of killing both of them. However, Knowles was pulled over by a police officer who eventually let him go with a warning. Now, apparently Knowles was shaken by this experience, as he let the two hitchhikers go in Miami before calling his lawyer. His lawyer suggested that Knowles surrender, and he ended up meeting his lawyer long enough to give a taped confession. A couple things I've seen have said that he slipped out of town before police could be informed of his presence. Personal opinion, I think it's more likely that Knowles needed to get what was ever on his chest off his chest before continuing on his way. He was next known to be in Macon, Georgia on November 6th, where he befriended Carswell Hall Carr Sr. at a bar, and Carr was so taken by Knowles that he invited the man back to his house, where they continued drinking, and Knowles ended up stabbing Carr to death before turning on Carr's 16-year-old daughter, Amanda Beth, whom he strangled to death before attempting to have sex with her corpse, something that Knowles found he was unable to do. Now, Knowles fled from Macon after this, and a couple different things I have seen have said that Knowles was suspected in two more murders, which took place on November 2nd, which was before his murders of the Carr family, and that was of hitchhiker Edward Hillard, who was found in some nearby woods, and his companion, Debbie Griffin, whose body has never been found. 2 days after the Cars murders, he was in Atlanta, again bar hopping, and he met British journalist Sandy Fawkes. He impressed her with his quote-unquote gaunt good looks, and they spent the night together. Knowles, who was unable to reform in bed, later told police that he suspected his problem of having sex with the woman, and the subsequent failed attempts to have sex over the next few days was a result of being unable to have sex at this point with a willing partner. At this point, Knowles was beginning to spiral in his psychosis, and he and Fawkes ended up separating on November 10th, after which Knowles picked up one of her friends, Susan McKenzie. This was on the 11th of November, and reportedly Knowles demanded sex of the woman at gunpoint. She was able to escape and notify police. However, when the police tried to stop Knowles, it was a single patrolman, he brandished a shotgun at the man before escaping. And here's where the story of John Paul Knowles gets good and, in my opinion, takes a twist which is unlike many other true crime cases. In fact, it's almost something out of a movie. On the morning of November 16th, a Florida highway patrolman named Charles Campbell recognized the stolen car outside of Perry, Florida, which, as I understand it, is near West Palm Beach, and Campbell attempted to make an arrest, but, and there's a couple different versions of this. One has it that John Paul Knowles was able to wrestle Campbell's gun away from him. The other is that Knowles pulled a gun on Campbell as soon as he approached the car. The result was the same, however, as Campbell was taken hostage and Knowles took off in the patrol car, using the siren to stop a motorist by the name of James Meyer. And at this point, he took Meyer hostage as well before stealing Meyer's vehicle and taking off from the area. He drove up to Pulaski County, Georgia. And at this point, Knowles was sick of having two hostages with them, so he ended up handcuffing the men to a tree in the middle of nowhere out in the woods before shooting both men in the head, execution style. Now, at this point, again, Knowles is... it was all over the news that John Paul Knowles was on the run, and the police knew who he was, citizens knew who he was. Knowles ended up getting into a car chase with a Henry County sheriff named Charles Hancock, and in a scene straight out of the movie First Blood with Sylvester Stallone, Knowles attempted to plow through a police roadblock, and he ended up losing control of his car and crashing into a tree. Now, one of the deputies who was in the roadblock was injured in this attempt to plow through. A gunfight ensued afterwards, with Knowles getting shot in the foot before he took off, running through the countryside with police officers from multiple jurisdictions, canine units, as well as helicopters hunting for him. However, the next day, Knowles was apprehended by a civilian, of all things. He was a 27-year-old Vietnam veteran named David Clark, and Clark had apparently seen, you know, what was on the news concerning the fugitive in the area, and he cornered Knowles with a shotgun before forcing him to the home of Joe and Becky Stonecipher, at which point Becky called the police. And it should be noted that had Clark not intervened, it's very possible Knowles would have escaped and continued on with his murderous rampage, as he was outside of the parameters the police had set up. Once in custody, Knowles claimed to have killed as many as 30 people. However, only between 18 and 20 murders have been able to be confirmed. But the story of John Paul Knowles wasn't over yet. The next day, on December 18th, 1974, Knowles was being transferred down Interstate 20 to Henry County, Georgia, where Knowles had stated he dropped the handgun that he had killed Trooper Charles Campbell and motorist James Meyer with. Now, in the car with Knowles was Sheriff Earl Lee and GBI agent Ronnie Engel. Now, the official report is that Knowles had been handcuffed in the back seat of their car, and at some point, he grabbed Sheriff Lee's handgun, discharging it through the holster in the process while Lee was struggling with Knowles and attempting to keep control of the vehicle. So I want you to picture this. Somehow Knowles was able to get his hands up into the front seat and grab a hold of the driver's handgun and set it off inside the holster. And while this is going on, the driver, Lee, is fighting with Knowles, after which Agent Engel shot Knowles 3 times in the chest. Now, I can't say for certain that this is actually what has happened. There's another podcast out there, True Crime Garage, which I'm a fan of, and I actually like the two guys that do it, and they have hypothesized that Knowles was actually murdered by these two police officers because of the things he had done specifically to children, and I think it's more likely that that is what happened. I don't think Knowles went for the gun. I think the two officers executed him and then came up with the story after the fact. And I say that because, having been handcuffed before, unless you're carrying a handcuff key, it's almost impossible to work your wrists in any normal fashion, especially if you're in the back of a car. It'd be next to impossible to get your hands onto a gun that's in the front seat inside of a holster without everyone in the car noticing it. Again, unless Knowles was able to, you know, hide a handcuff key on his person and then undo said cuffs in order to do it. Which, from everything I have seen, there is no evidence of that having taken place. But there is some evidence that Knowles did have a death wish. And at this point, I'm going to play an excerpt from a conversation Knowles had with a psychologist. I don't own the copyright to this recording. I'm only sharing it for the purposes of reporting news and information.
Okay, so I was a little bit of who I was born in. I have been since I was born. I realized there was a lack of, maybe not a lack of will, but a lack of hearing. But I know God, they love me, but they just didn't get me.
Well, if you love somebody, how can you not get with that?
It's possible. Well, perhaps they did give a damn, but they just didn't know how to show it. In 3 days of party, just rode around town, went to the shooting galleries, penny arcades, and stuff. Just whatever
didn't go on.
Sleeping in the room. And then they called me. And they sent me in. And the next day I was in school, and they called me across the street to the police station. They sort of told me to, get me, And that was when they sent me out.
If you could change your life from the point you're at right now, where would you go back to make the change?
Well, actually, if I had to live over again, I wouldn't.
You wouldn't do one.
I wouldn't have any of that.
It's been that bad.
There's no way I'd go through another year of it.
I never did decide to go back.
I decided I wasn't going back. It's just chance of fate that I am going. See, I had no intention of living.
How do you mean that?
I fully intended to be shot before I was arrested.
So there we have it, in his own words, John Paul Knowles talking about his views on his life and specifically not wishing to live and, in fact, really not being happy with the fact that he was born. Now, it is known that he had made what were called kill tapes, where he discussed every one of the murders he committed, as well as the ones that have not been verified, and he made these with the intention of his mother being able to profit off of them after his death. Unfortunately, these tapes were destroyed in a flood at a courthouse at some point in the past. But I would be interested in seeing if there are transcripts anywhere out there that are available to the public. I did a quick online search and was unable to find them. So that is the story of the Casanova killer, John Paul Knowles, the man who was basically just too miserable to die and too free to live by the norms of society. Hope you'd enjoyed this look at him today. Before we get out of here, I'm gonna do something I rarely, if ever, do, which is plug one of my own works. It's a book by the title of The Throwaway Girls of Olympia. It was the most difficult thing I have written to date. That includes ghostwriting a book for a retired professional wrestler, and I had really no stake in the book or idea of what the story was about, but I still went ahead and did it, and from what I understand, it is doing fairly well in sales. Now, The Throwaway Girls of Olympia is a crime thriller slash drama. I want to say it's similar in the vein of, Death Wish or the Dirty Harry movie. When I said Death Wish, I meant the book, not the film. It's a very gritty, dark story about a small-time sheriff trying to track a serial killer in his town with the help of a FBI agent. I'm going to read you guys two of the most recent reviews I have gotten on the book. One of them is by a fairly famous author who I will not name. And the other one, I'm not certain who it's from, but I was pleased with both of them. So here's the first one. Deep, dark, and diabolical. The Throwaway Girls of Olympia is a fearless jaunt into places few authors dare to take their readers, and I, for one, appreciate the guts it takes to go there. And there are a lot of moments in this book that definitely go there. I finished this book in record time and wanted more. Recommended for lovers of dark crime fiction. Next one is from Canada, and to all my Canadian friends up north, hello. I know there's a lot of you that listen to this podcast. A psychologically disturbing read. There is so much that could be said about the Throwaway Girls of Olympia that I have no idea where to actually begin. It was my first time reading a book by Mr. Totten, but I was intrigued by the synopsis and wanted to follow his protagonist on his journey of solving the series of horrific murders. I was expecting the standard thriller and murder mystery, but it was so far from being that. It would be an understatement to say that there were many unsettling moments of repulsion, and I was very surprised where he took the story. So there you have it, two reviews from my latest book, which came out March 9th of last year, 2020. It's available on Amazon and Kindle, as well as pretty much anywhere you can get books. So if you're interested, go give it a read, leave a review. I'd love to hear what people think of it. The book of this week, again, is Dream Reaper by Aleister Cross. It is a really good book. I can't sing its praises enough. Cross has a very unique writing style that was different from a lot of other horror authors that I've read, and I really enjoyed it. And he's also a really, really good guy. Also going to do one quick shout-out to my friends over at the Booking the Territory, the unprofessional pro wrestling podcast. They're the ones that gave me the idea for the show last week on the death of Chris Adams. And I know two of the guys that are on it, Mike Mills and Chris Harper, and they're really good guys. So if you're into crass Andrew Dice Clay humor, and talk of old professional wrestling, I can't suggest their show enough. They're really, really funny. That's it for the Deathcast this week. Again, if you want to follow me on social media, I'm on pretty much every social website you can think of, I think with the exception of Reddit. But in places like MeWe and a couple other different ones that are outside of Facebook and Twitter, which I'm also on. And I've gotten a couple angry fan mail letters from various people concerned that I'm on these not so mainstream social media websites. And my response is simple. Crackpots who believe in conspiracy theories buy books too, so why should I limit myself only to a small portion of the population online? Having said that, that's the Deathcast for this week. Until next week, I am your host, Ian Totten. Stay safe and be morbid.
Welcome to the Deathcast.